Welcome to Capital Connections. I'm Jackie Yamanaka. On this week's show, our guests will discuss legislative efforts to make Montana an attractive site for two emerging industries. One is adding value to a traditional industry, agriculture, while the other is to tap into the high-tech industry that's burgeoning in the state. Capital Connections contributor Chuck Johnson sits down with Senator Mark Blaisdell to talk about large data, or server centers, that serve the global technology infrastructure. Montana is seeking to be the home to large data farms to serve what's commonly called the cloud. First, we'll discuss an emerging crop that's gaining growers in Montana with Representative Rob Cook of Conrad on how pulses are beginning to change Montana agriculture and the potential for adding value to a crop for overseas exports. Welcome, Representative Rob Cook. Thank you so much for coming in and visiting with me about pulse crops. And you're up there in Conrad, in the Conrad area. And I think the best way is to first lay a little bit of background and tell our listeners, what are pulse crops?
Well, thank you, Jackie. I'm glad that you had me here this morning. But so a pulse crop, the word pulse is just kind of a collective word for peas, chickpeas, and lentils. So it's crops of those sorts. And, you know, of course, we're starting to see from the Rocky Mountain front to North Dakota a tremendous increase in production capacity across the Montana highline. In fact, Montana just recently took over as the number one state for the production of pulse crops.
And also there is look at not just growing pulse crops, whether peas, lentils, chickpeas, also taking that next step.
Correct. You know, one of the most exciting things for Montana is this is an opportunity where we're on the ground floor with a new crop to begin to build the industries that add value to these crops before we ship them out. Currently in Montana, 80% of the pulse crops that are grown here go outside of the state for production processing. And so the hope and the dream would be to bring that processing back to rural towns along the Montana highline.
And can you talk a little bit about what you see as how pulse crops fit into sort of the traditional view Montanans have of agriculture, whether it's grains and then livestock?
Well, actually, they fit in nicely on the farming side of Montana agriculture. Pulse crops, actually, you know, most of Montana's farmland is unirrigated, and so you traditionally under traditional systems, you get one crop every 2 years, so you're fallow every other year. Yeah, with a pulse crop, you actually can go two production years if you rotate wheat, barley with a pulse crop the following year. So you get two crops in 3 years, which means you pick up an extra crop in every six-year period. So you instantaneously get what is about a 17% increase in production.
And what do you see the sort of the trickle-down effects for communities like yours?
Well, it's really not even trickle-down. I mean, it's direct. It's a direct application of manufacturing to ag products to produce the value that's needed. So we should probably talk about that a little bit. The first phase in pulse processing is simple, but it can be expensive. And essentially, what you have to do is, with a pulse crop, you have to clean it. Which is common with all ag crops, but the pulse crop, you have to clean it, destone it, and then you have to, if it's going directly to a food market, you color sort it. And the color sorting process is very expensive. It's highly automated. It's done with lasers and little air jets that blow the defective pea or bean or whatever it is you're looking at off of a conveyor while they slide past at tremendous velocities. And then, you have to bag it. And so what this phase of the processing gets us in Montana is a typical plant would be about a total investment of $18 million. And within that, there's about $8 million of what we would traditionally classify as business equipment in Montana. And so that's kind of your proportion. These plants would employ 6 to 12 people, have payrolls of $300,000 to $600,000. So they'd be a big hitter in any of the towns along the Montana highline.
And do we have any facilities at all to process these crops, these pulse crops?
But currently we have, I believe that we just have two. So one is in Chester And actually, that may be the only one. And there's talk about sticking another plant or a bigger plant in Plentywood. But we're sorely lacking in this capacity to treat treat the pulse crops in this first phase. And then, of course, there are many subsequent phases that you can do as well, and they're very interesting. Another phase of especially on the pea side. Now, when we talk about peas for agriculture, we're not talking about green garden peas. What we're talking about is it's a yellow pea, and it has a tremendous protein content. And so what we do with those, that would be phase two processing in the grand scheme of value added, is it's a process called fractionation, which is how we extract the protein from the pea. And this protein is used everywhere, from animal feed to human energy drinks. Those processes are you can dry fractionate or you can wet fractionate, and it's actually fascinating science, but I'm sure I'll probably bore you to death. So,
and I think Great Falls is trying to get that pea fractionation plant. So
yes, and also there is a company in Billings. I probably shouldn't name the company, but they're also looking at what a process of dry fractionation to use in their products. Which include a lot of human food food items. So,
now let's go to your House Bill 614, and you talked a little bit about the equipment side and the tax side, and how your bill, your House Bill 614, plays into, I guess, you know, for Montana, get this industry off the ground.
Right. Now, House Bill 614 is just a proposal to exempt the business equipment tax, so the business equipment from taxation. And as we went over, we're talking about a ratio of, what, about $18 million to $8 million. So you'd still have $10 million that stayed with the local property base. The $8 million would be exempted for a period of 10 years, then the bill sunsets. And quite honestly, you know, I'm a Republican, and if these sorts of incentives can't get an industry off the ground in 10 years, then the odds are they never will. So,
okay, so at that point, then they would just pay the full business equipment tax under whatever tax structure the Montana legislature has. I know there are efforts to completely eliminate that tax.
Yeah, correct. You know, again, we can go into business equipment tax and the efforts to eliminate it maybe a little bit here, but you know, in general, that's not a really good idea. Given that property taxes are ad valorem, meaning that the counties and the cities are allowed to collect at least as much revenue as they had in the previous year. Every time you go in and directly reduce the business equipment tax, you have to have a backfill to the counties or the cities to make up for that. So, I don't think we'll ever get to a complete elimination of business equipment, but you can suspend it for a period of time to try to incentivize somebody to make the investment. And so that's the thought of the 10-year sunset.
Can you let our listeners know how competitive is it for other states, you know, whether it's North Dakota, for example, our neighbor to the east, to attract these plants? I mean, what is your understanding of what is it going to take to get a higher level of adding value to this crop to get something here?
Well, I think this proposal in and of itself is enough to attract that investment. Having talked with the industry, in fact, we just recently had a plant that did locate in North Dakota, right across the Montana border, in order to service Montana crops. And so, there is under traditional Montana tax structure, and I guess by traditional I mean existing, there is what's called a new equipment tax abatement process. The issue you have is that it has to be approved. And it frequently is not. So then the investors make the decision to go somewhere where it has been approved. Under this proposal, the proposal in House Bill 614, what we've essentially done is we've eliminated that proposal cycle for 10 years, so that there's no danger to the investor that whatever abatement they're going to receive goes away.
Do you see, you know, once further plants pop up, that more and more producers are going to add pulse to to whatever they offer.
Oh, most certainly. I see this. I see the pulse crops probably as the next generation of Montana farm products. It's undeniable. First of all, you get an instantaneous 17% increase in the production capacity of your land, right? If you're a dry land farmer. Second of all, I've seen the numbers, and 1 acre of chickpeas generates the same net revenue of 7 acres of wheat. So once again, then you have that additive on top of it. You see some decrease in the fertilizer side of things you have to do, but then it's kind of a net thing in the ag chemicals that you have to apply. But I don't know how you could be a farmer and ignore the potential of pulse crops.
And it's largely exported.
Yeah, fundamentally it is. The U.S. market is a high-end market for we'll call it gourmet pulse crops, for lack of a better word, right? Whereas the world market was traditionally centered in India and Asia, which is very much a low-end commodity market. What you get when you add the ability to color sort and do those sorts of processing steps is you get entry into the Middle East and the Mediterranean, which are medium end markets, and they pay much higher price. So it adds value in many more ways than just being able to take your crop to market. It changes the markets that you can send your crop to.
Right, and it's my understanding that our land grant college is working also on trying to develop crops that are specific for the Montana climate, the Montana soils.
Yeah, absolutely. Our ag extension centers now have begun to make pulse crops a part of their focus. The other thing a pulse crop gets you is that, especially we'll take the triangle where I'm from and the entire High Line, is that, the repetitive recropping of the same crop again and again has led to, we'll take one instance here where we've got an infestation of sawfly in wheat. And what sawfly does is it cuts the stem off. So when it comes time to harvest, your crop's all laying on the ground, and either you cut it early and windrow it, it costs money to account for the sawfly. Well, the interruption of those crop cycles, of course, leads to much more difficulty in the sawfly being able to propagate from year to year. So the natural rotation of crops has many more benefits than just fixing nitrogen and those sorts of things. It takes care of parasites and diseases and insects and all of that as well.
Anything else, Representative Cook, that you would like to add about pulse crops and all of a sudden a lot of interest in Montana and what the legislature might or maybe should do?
Well, the question is always, again, I'm a Republican, so the question is, should you pick a winner, right? Should government incentivize winners and losers? And especially in ag, there's a lot of feelings in ag, especially from the animal side to the crop side, about what should or shouldn't be incentivized. One of the arguments I heard in the hearing was that, well, if you're not willing to incentivize a meat packing plant, well, then why would you incentivize a pulse processing plant? Well, in fact, we have the ability to do both today. And a meat packing facility is a much, much, much more expensive investment to begin with. And so the likelihood that you're going to get the local abatement would go up. And so in this case, and an argument for these incentives, let's look what happened to the microbrewing industry in Montana, right? With this business equipment exemption has existed for them without a sunset, unfortunately, but without a sunset for quite a while now, and it's led to explosive growth in our local breweries. And the only thing I wish they would have had was a sunset as well. I think there's a point either in your production cycle, how many barrels a day you produce, or a time limit where you should actually the incentive should phase out. And of course, House Bill 614 was built around this incentive.
Well, with that, that will be the last word. We'll end on microbrews, even though we've been talking about pulse crops. Thank you so much, Representative Rob Cook, for joining us.
Well, thank you. And as of yet, nobody's tried to malt a pea or lentil, so we'll see where that goes.
You never know. Thank you. Oh, beautiful, more spacious sky.
Hello, we're here with Senator Mark Blaisdell, a Republican from Kalispell, and welcome to the show.
You bet. Thank you so much.
We'd like to talk to you today about your bill, Senate Bill 359, which would give a tax incentive for what are called data farms or data centers. What is a data farm?
Sure. Data farms or data centers, they're starting to pop up a lot all over in the Northwest and also even down to Texas. These are the large server facilities that store a large amount of data for either companies or for different entities of, you know, in the same fields. And they're large landmass facilities. I mean, up to 1 million square feet facilities. They have large, long connected racks of storage equipment where they hold I'd say two of the best cases would be a Google or a Facebook. All that data, the videos that you see, all the different information that's on there is all stored on these racks and these facilities. But it goes into the healthcare professions. It goes into a number of different entities that have this where it's all in one place, one facility. They're highly secure. They have to put a large amount of work into them to keep the climate in them correct so that they're not having to deal with humidity and different temperature changes. Most of them are very, very set up. I know the one that the state has, you have to look at earthquake situations, so they're on the movable racks so that if there's an earthquake, they move. I mean, they're just amazing facilities with a lot of technology, a lot of electrical buildup into them. And it's just kind of a new technology that's starting to really move forward.
Where's the state's data center? Is that?
We have two. We have a small one in here in Helena, just kind of the south of us. And then we also have a backup facility in Miles City.
And have either government agencies or private companies expressed interest in putting them in Montana? Or is that what your bill's all about, to attract their interest?
It's to attract their interest, but I think the interest is there. Government, obviously, they have theirs. I think one of the mistakes that was made, I believe it was the 2009 session, is when we built these data centers for the state, we didn't mandate that the agencies had to move their equipment into there. So there's still some smaller data servers in each of the agencies that are starting to migrate that way. But I do think a lot of companies are here. They like our climate. They like our clean energy. That's one of the big protocols that they look at. Obviously, you have wind and solar, but they also view hydro as renewable, even though at the state of Montana level, we don't at this time. The climate, they love the topography of our land. We have water resources. So there's a lot of things here that they like. The biggest problem is exactly what this bill is trying to address, and that's how we centrally assess the taxes when you have all of the fiber optics and all that cross over county lines.
And how would your bill work, Senator?
Okay, currently, and I'll use an example from the Gallatin County Commissioners. They had a company that was looking at coming in with these transmission lines and the connectivity and how that runs across state or county lines at a 6% tax rate. This company, after all was said and done, would be paying over $1.32 to $1.3 billion in 10 years of taxes, and that was the non-starter. Everything else looks great. We're right in play. The struggle we have is you have states that are offering zero tax rates, long-term abatements, and this bill doesn't do that. This bill just sets them more at a fixed county assessed rate of 0.9%. So we're going to be getting tax revenue from them. Obviously, then the local municipalities and the economic development agencies in those areas have some tools between abatements and other things that they can offer. But at the state level, we're not running at a 0% like some states. We will be able to collect it. And then you got to look at all the other possibilities with that.
And the bill, I looked up the votes, it passed pretty handily in the Senate. Third reading was 40 to 10. And where's it at right now?
It's in House tax. I believe they're going to take executive action on it today. I have offered some amendments to bring that tax rate up a little bit after some conversations with different folks, and also to try to tighten up some of the language that to make sure that this is all on one parcel of contiguous land. They're not going to be able to have 10 different servers across the state. To make sure that we're really trying to not create any loopholes here. It should be moving forward out of the House Tax Committee today, I'm hoping, and then hopefully get a good positive vote on the floor before we get it to the governor.
Have you had any conversations with the governor or his staff about whether he'd be likely to sign it if it reaches his desk?
We have had some tentative discussions with his staff and also with the Department of Revenue. They've shared some of their concerns, which I've tried to fix some of those with the amendments that I'm going to be offering today. Obviously, I mean, Department of Revenue's biggest job here is to protect the state and protect the general fund coffers. But I also think there's a fine line between doing too much and the fact that we got to realize that you can't tax what we don't have. And right now we don't have any of these being built here. There's interest, and the way to get them foot in their door is to create opportunities for them to look at Montana as a viable state.
In terms of employment, how many people would one of these centers employ to build it, and then how many people to keep it operating once it's in operation?
Sure. I think my provision now will set up, I think it's a 300,000 square foot center that it's got to be. We're looking at anywhere from 700 to 1,000 construction jobs that should run anywhere from 2 to 4 years. At times, it'll be up to 200 to 300 electricians on site at one time. What happens with these is once one's built and the fiber and everything is laid, typically that means that there's going to be 2 to 3 more in that area. So you're looking at some long-term construction jobs in that area as well. Once they're built, depending on the size and the involvement, on site, typically there's anywhere from 40 to 50 to 70 to 100, depending on the size. Plus, you have the ancillary jobs of security, maintenance, the other items. Most of these professions are in the $75,000-plus a year job with full benefits. And I think one of the other great things that doesn't always get looked at with them is their investment back into the community. These folks come with families. They're looking for the quality of life. I think a great example is what's happening in Bozeman with the big IT boom down there. And then the reinvestment that they do back into the schools with IT and different issues. I've spoken with folks over in Wenatchee at times where they invest a lot into those public education schools, promoting the school, the IT programs and computer programming and so forth as well, because their kids are going through those schools as well, and they want to see the best possible for them.
Now, typically in bills like this, and I've covered them over the years, some people say, well, why give a tax incentive to build something here when you're not giving a tax incentive to the businesses that have been here for years? What's your response to that?
Well, I think this is our chance. There's a lot that can be done with some of our tax systems, especially on that centrally assessed, be it transmission lines, pipelines, and so forth. And I think we're going to keep working on that. We're studying that again over the interim. But this is one of those opportunities that you have to get ahead of the game. They're not here now in what we're looking at in the capacities. This is a chance for us to get ahead, open our doors to a new and emerging market before it gets too late to be able to address the tax situation. And so I keep an open mind with all different entities and how their tax rates are set. And obviously I've carried bills in the past to try to address that with some of the other ones. And I think this is just the opportunity to start ahead of time before they're here, before trying to go back and change things afterwards.
Now, do these centers, is this what the cloud is? Is that a fair description?
Yes, it is.
Okay. And do the companies typically own their own, or does one center handle, Facebook mm-hmm. part of it?
There's two different ways. Sometimes the companies will build their own. I do know of also that there are companies that build them and then lease them, their racks and their storage to different entities. I mean, it's pretty amazing how much information can be stored in one of these. You take the state data center, it could basically store all of the statewide data, all of the local municipality and schools and university system data, and still have a pretty nice set of space that they could use for long-term growth. So some of them are single entities for single purposes and single companies. Some store for a lot of different areas and a lot of different arenas, and they're leased out by one individual that's built them.
And have companies visited with you about potential places they'd like to build them if something like this comes through?
I haven't necessarily spoke with any individual companies. I dropped this bill in about a year and a half ago, Jim, and this came from my work on the Efficiencies in Government Committee back in 2011, where we looked at a lot of IT ideas. Once I dropped that bill draft in, I think Bozeman's probably the farthest ahead of the game as far as this, just because of their IT sector down there. Their economic development team's very forward-thinking on this, and they've been in contact with some companies about possibilities on how to do this. Since that time, Shelby has now contacted me. They're looking at some different economic development areas up there about the possibilities of how this could work for them. I envision this places like Butte out there. They have their trade area out there where Silicon and CCAST, and that is. I look at Frenchtown in Missoula. There's a large land mass there that at some point in time, once cleanup and everything's done, up in my area in Flathead County, you have the CFAC plant. That's a large land mass. At one time, I think they were using the fifth most amount of energy of any entity in the state, so that those resources are all there, so that might be a possibility. And I think there's other areas too, so I think if this bill passes, it'll be up to those local areas to start identifying what they can do and if this is something that they want to get involved in.
Did any of the high-tech companies come and testify for the bill, or did you have the Chamber of Commerce and people like that came in?
Yeah, we had, I believe, the Chamber of Commerce came in. We've also had the Gallatin, Shelby has been involved in it, there's been a few other ones. I think the contractors have looked at it quite a bit, and so I think there's a lot of excitement here that if we can open this door and let the local areas work at it, I think you could see some exciting things in the next 2 to 3 years.
Very good. Thank you very much for sharing the time with the Senator, and good luck on your bill.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Capital Connections. Thank you for joining us. Our theme music is courtesy of the Alex Nauman Trio. You can find this and past programs on our website, ypradio.org. Capital Connections is a production of YPR News.